Welcome to the Valley Outdoors, and as always, we are excited to have you guys with us this week. We got some fun topics. We're going to talk a little ice fishing. We're also going to talk about first confirmed wolf kill in Colorado.
Oh, really?
In a livestock scenario. We're going to talk a little bit about that. And this one's surprising me. They're going to expand walleye fishing in a certain area of Michigan because the walleye are eating too much perch. That's right. Stay tuned for that one and more when we return. Eric Olson here, professional walleye tour champion, avid outdoorsman, and host of the Valley Outdoors radio show. Aquatic invasive species, or AIS, threatens not only our rivers and lakes here, but everywhere we boat. They come in many forms, and they love to hitch a ride to the next body of water on your boat or trailer. Join me to stop the spread of AIS by cleaning all weeds and aquatic material from your trailer before leaving the launch ramp. Drain live wells and clean areas that don't drain completely. Plus, don't forget to pull the plug. Clean, drain, dry. Together, we can make a difference. Good to see you guys.
Good to see you.
Yeah. Happy New Year.
Yeah. Well, it's happened.
It's the new year.
It's 2022. That's whenever you sign anything, you got to remember. It's 2022.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah. You want that's pretty common
screw
fault
up. Mm-hmm.
Is putting the wrong year down. You're writing a check or signing some document or something of that nature. You got to get the right...
Right info. I think I might actually go make some turns later on today down the hill in like minus whatever degree temperature it is.
It's cold here.
I'm
going to
make
Minnesota.
My own wind chill.
You have fun.
Speaking of having fun and out in the cold, figured I'd bring up a couple tips I thought were pretty good for ice fishing. I thought they're unique. Couple of them, which you're going to say, wonder why I didn't think of that. Vertical to horizontal with your ice fishing. The style of one ice jig is just as important as the color. Most anglers are accustomed to a teardrop-shaped jig that hangs vertically in the water, such as any one of those standard teardrop jigs you'll find anywhere in the sporting goods aisle. When the fish stop biting the vertical jig, switch to a jig that goes horizontally, like a jigging wrap, small size, same concept, and it swings and will sail at various angles. So it totally changes the look. And the presentation, exactly. Now, this next one I thought was amazing. I'd never thought of it. And in fact, I only think of this as being a detriment, and it has to do with line twist. As soon as I hear line twist, I'm like, that's not a good thing. Most anglers only move their jig in an up and down jigging motion. Fish become obviously accustomed to that presentation and will stop reacting to that scenario. For a change of pace, try holding the line between your index finger and thumb and roll or twist the line between your fingers. It causes the jig to spin in the water while remaining at the same depth. And then try moving a jig around the perimeter of the hole without imparting any up-down motion on the jig. They respond especially well to that technique in shallow water.
Roll the line between your fingers.
Yeah, so it spins the jig, and then you can work it around the perimeter of the...
Got it.
Yeah. Bait to plastic, live bait, give it a break, and try to work with some finesse plastic lures. Bluegills and other panfish eventually tire of live bait when it happens. Usually switch to a tiny 1/80th ounce round head jig, which is literally not even hardly a jig, and just a
sliver
of plastic.
I've never seen a 1/80th.
And finesse plastic tail, tiny jig quivers. It's basically just not even hardly anything there.
How's it go down?
So, with another weight, usually put another weight. Like it's almost a fly.
Yeah.
So, bouncing in the bottom, add a certain element to it. Instead of holding it suspended, bounce it off the bottom, making the poof on the bottom if it's a softer type silty bottom.
Sure.
And usually, a prime example for me in freshwater or open water, you drop the jig, you pop, lift it. And normal people jig and they lift up 2 feet. A lot of times I'll drop it, pull it up and hold it, maybe like 3-4 inches off the bottom, just hold it. And depending on the bite, they'll react to that stop because the bait's like a dying bait or a dying minnow. So that works pretty good as well. Looking down the hole for a stiff neck and a few more fish, try staring down the hole and watching fish as they take the bait if you don't have a camera. It's excellent for learning how fish respond to various baits and jigging techniques. So kind of a concept. It's always fun watching them, as long as you can see.
If you're in shallow enough water, yep.
Yep. Changing sizes, obviously that's a big thing. Go from a size 10 teardrop jig to a size 6, or go to an ultra-small size 12. That's always a good method as well. And put the rod down when fishing with a spring bobber, like some of the new panfish popper rods, a simple way to catch a couple extra fish. Set the rod down and allow the fish, the bait, to sit totally motionless. And we found that, too, was an effective method when we were jigging. All we did, we were trying to figure out what was going on with the bite. One day it was great, next day not very good. And we just cast out the bait, and it wasn't really paying it much attention. It was dragging on the sand bottom, and all of a sudden I got a fish. And I thought, well, what in the world? They just wanted to have a flat nothing drag presentation. So don't be afraid not to do anything. That's definitely something to look at.
I actually use that method quite often, long lining.
Mm-hmm. You can do it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Again, it just depends on your speed, the and the line angle, what kind of jig you're doing. And other thing to keep in mind is not using ultralight monofilament for deeper water. Use a braid is one of the big things that you can do is an ultralight braid. And then you can also look at putting on a fluorocarbon leader.
Sure.
And you're going to be able to get, if it's longer distances out, you're going to be able to get that feel, and you're going to still have the line cutting or water cutting capability with that braid to give you a hand with that. So that works for sure. It's one of those things.
Lots of techniques.
Yeah, and it's so different with that because for me, it just takes me a long time to cut that hole of the ice from the launch ramp and drive the boat. It takes a long time to get that open hole all the way out to the middle of the lake.
Yeah, it's trolling's always been a problem for
me. Well, and I just go one way, and then I have to go back.
Right.
So you want one way you're going forward, and then the other one you're back trolling. So you cover the whole deal. You get out to the center, you just simply back up and go back to the ramp. And
I had a guy offer to chainsaw me a slot in the ice once. If I wanted to go along, I go, nah, that's okay.
It's a sad joke, but I got to tell you. It's like some of those guys that jig out that cut that big circle in the ice. You put an outboard motor on it and you control.
I'd be afraid that thing would tip.
No.
No, I know. I've seen them, but it's...
It would be entertaining, though. Put a crankbait on about 3 different holes out there and just spin the crankbaits around the...
Yeah, just for a video.
It would probably work. I don't know. What do I know?
Right.
Apparently not much, because I brought up the idea. All right. Well, speaking of more lame-brained ideas, we're going to be back with a bunch more. Stay tuned. Well, Donald, we always like to have everybody check us out on Facebook and
TheValleyOutdoors.com.
TheValleyOutdoors.com. Lots of cool stuff on the website. Links. We've got the interactive map. Wherever you want to find something out on in the outdoors in the season, maybe where you're going. And we're just talking about it, Don. We'll be coming up next week. We'll have some updates for the license requirements if you're heading out west next year, because those are going to be coming up due, or you need to get your name in relatively soon, because a lot of them have a late January due.
Yeah, I know Wyoming. If you're a non-resident and plan to apply for an elk license, you need to do that before the end of January. I think you can start in the next few days, but you're going to want to get that applied for if you're planning to do elk in Wyoming next year.
Right. So we'll come up with a list next week for next week's show, and we'll make sure you guys have that updated. That will also appear on thevalleyoutdoors.com. We can upload it there and have it so people can just click and be loaded and ready to rock and roll at that point. So that'll work. But I used to go out there quite a bit, out to Broadus, and hunt with my dad out there. And I'll tell you what, you go out in the morning, they're there, and then anytime after like 9 o'clock in the morning, it's like they dug a hole, crawled in it, and they're breathing out of a straw until the evening. They just disappear. They go to the draws and everything else. You can't see them.
You're talking the elk?
Well, mule deer primarily.
Okay.
But yeah. And then, of course, we're heading home, or we're heading out of the ranch we were staying, and here's about a 5x5 elk standing right next to the road. It wasn't elk territory. We're like, what do you got to do? I mean, every time you turn around, it's like totally opposite of
what you think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a fun experience.
I have never hunted Wyoming or Montana, but I have Idaho, and I was there for 7 days, and the only elk we saw was the one that one of the other guys brought back to camp.
You can get stuck in a bad area.
That wasn't a bad area. No kidding. The following week.
It was timing.
It was timing. The following week, every hunter.
Got it.
They got 7x7s.
Oof.
Yeah.
Nice. Those are some nice animals.
Yep.
They really are. Speaking of some nice animals, I caught one of these. Well, actually, several of these this year. But the story that I've got is what makes this whole thing amazing. The sturgeon was tagged 26 years ago. It resurfaced in the exact same location.
He had moved.
Obviously, this is out of the Hudson River estuary. Recently, while working on a two-year short-nosed sturgeon stock assessment in the mid-Hudson River tidewaters, biologists caught a short-nosed sturgeon that had been tagged 26 years ago in the exact same location. The fish had been tagged during the last population estimate conducted by Mark Bain of the Cornell University. At the time, the short nose was 25.6 inches and estimated to be 15 years old. When it was recaptured, it was 34 inches and having approximately 11 millimeters growth per year.
It's not a lot.
No. Based on the length and age of the original capture, the short-nosed was now likely to be more than 40 years old. Short-nosed sturgeon was the first fish listed as a federally endangered species act in the 1973 act that they enabled. And they are the smallest of the three New York State sturgeons, and they rarely grow very large and exceed more than 18 pounds in weight. So
that's a small sturgeon from what we think of.
Yeah, they mature at 10 years old, and they're rarely exceeding 4 feet long. And pretty cool. I know the one I caught out here, we estimated was over 60 inches. We didn't bring it in the boat. We pulled it alongside the boat, marked where the nose was, when he reached the tail, and then I still had it on the line, and then I basically just pulled it and broke it off. I didn't want to have to stress the fish out that bad, but it was over 60 inches, and talk about a fight in 3.5-4 feet of water. It was amazing. It was casting a rip and wrap.
What kind of line did you have on?
10-pound nano braid with a 15-pound fluorocarbon leader on it.
Okay.
You can pretty much reef on them if you've drag and the rod and everything are good.
Set right.
You can haul on them pretty hard. You know, the main line, I go lighter weight. The braid or the fluorocarbon's heavier because it's going to encounter either zebras or rocks or whatever, and I want to not be below the rest of the line. So it definitely helps a lot.
But, sure.
And it provides some reduction in the visibility, so it can't see the line. Not that it's a big deal necessarily in a river. And but that 4 feet of water was pretty outstanding fun.
Splashed
it jumped
it
like a
bit.
Dolphin.
Yeah.
It came out of the water in a long, he was just hauling the mail. Jumps out of the water, probably about a foot and a half out of the water, the whole big body, you know, not vertical, but yep. Horizontal, just right. Like he was going
porpoising.
Fast, porpoising. And that was crazy.
You don't think of them moving that fast, though.
No. No, you don't. No, no, not at all. Not at all. Story we highlighted at the top of the show, Colorado has confirmed its first wolf kill of livestock in decades. The in Colorado, voters narrowly passed a proposition last year to direct state wildlife officials to develop a plan to reintroduce an undetermined number of gray wolves into the state west of the Continental Divide by the end of 2023. And Denver, they have confirmed that a domestic calf is found dead in northern Colorado, killed by wolf or wolves. It's difficult to tell, marking the first wolf-related livestock fatality in the state in decades. Colorado Park of Wildlife officials said Tuesday they performed an necropsy after receiving a report of a calf carcass on a ranch in the North Park area. The results indicates wolf tracks in the immediate vicinity of the carcass and found wounds of calf were consistent with wolf depredation. The CPW will handle reimbursement to the ranch as if the calf were attacked by a mountain lion or bears. The agency has formalized an official process for damage by wolves and is working on a draft regulations involving wolves that migrate into the state. The Colorado Cattlemen's Association said in the news release that if confirmed, the death would be the first more than 70 years.
Wow.
So that's quite a long time. And they, of course, we mentioned earlier, they passed the resolution to introduce wolves, and gray wolf pups have already been spotted in the state this year. So what do you think about them, Apples?
It's interesting how things evolve. Now, that doesn't mean there's going to be a problem because it's the first occurrence in 70 years, but I'm sure they're going to have their eyes on it, see if it continues to be an issue.
Yeah, and I think it will. There's a lot of that coming on Wisconsin-wise. They're looking at having, you know, they got a wolf hunt because of the number of wolves. They do grow relatively quickly as far as that goes. And that's going to be a big element to the whole, I think, the story and how it develops across the all the states that have wolves in their particular state.
Including Minnesota.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Hey, hang tight. We're going to be back. We're going to talk a little bit about the story from Michigan where walleye season is going to be expanding to help the perch out. Stay tuned. That and more when we return. Eric Olson here, professional walleye tour champion, avid outdoorsman, and host of the Valley Outdoors radio show. Aquatic invasive species, or AIS, threatens not only our rivers and lakes here, but everywhere we boat. They come in many forms, and they love to hitch a ride to the next body of water on your boat or trailer. Join me to stop the spread of AIS by cleaning all weeds and aquatic material from your trailer before leaving the launch ramp. Drain live wells and clean areas that don't drain completely. Plus, don't forget to pull the plug. Clean, drain, dry. Together, we can make a difference.
Don, we're gonna slip a story in that I thought was kind of cool regarding the Great Lakes. Now, one of the things that, when it comes to fishing charts, you've got a chart. You plug in a little chip that you put into your graph.
By the
and so many people now, you know, when I do a fishing seminar, we talk about graphing, hydrographic mapping. We talk about the hummingbird having the auto chart. We talk about how those really can benefit you. And one of the difficult things has been on the Canadian line or the Canadian side, they haven't really let many mapping companies come in and map. They've had that under very tight restrictions. They've recently slacked on that. A fair amount. You're able to get Rainy Lake, you're able to get Lake of the Woods, you're able to get Canadian sides, but it has been a very much tight wraps. And a neat thing is, just recently, this, as the story goes, there's an international effort underway to make high-res charts of the Great Lakes, because right now, many times, it's only 5-foot increments, and it's not that detailed. So in this particular case, the significant Great Lake areas, such as the area near Lake Superior, Standard Rock, they're well charted, but charts for most offshore areas are based on old scattered soundings. And a lot of times the soundings were very archaic in their methodology. I know that for a fact after you look at some of them in Michigan from tour events that we've had. It's surprising and then again understandable how little is known of the underwater topography of the Great Lakes. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Office of Coast Surveys, less than 15% of the lake floors of the Great Lakes have been mapped using high-res technology. Isn't that blows me away.
Yes.
Less than 15%. NOAA has absolutely, they do have charts available for most all of the U.S. portions of the Great Lakes, but much of the detailed maps are little more than educated guesses on what lies below. They're produced on a macro scale. Near shore waters, especially those near major ports, important passages and shipping lanes, and interesting areas like Lake Superior, Standard Rock have been scanned, measured, and plotted more or less extensively. However, the depths across much of the open water vastness of the lakes has been little more than soundings taken and recorded decades ago, only on a macro scale. So generally probably 10-foot increments at best, and not any significant details other than here's a line and it's going to follow because that's what we found. Sonar technologies that measure depths has only been available for 15 years or so, and GPS technology wasn't widely available until the mid-80s. Until then, soundings were taken the old-fashioned way, lowering a weight on the end of a cable. That's why I say extremely archaic, and you can't move quickly. So that's one of the big issues. Vectoring positions are required, used to require triangulating off of a known shoreline feature, if shore was available, or using sextants or perhaps diagonal directional radio signaling. And realistically, most of the hazard areas to navigation, such as Superior Shoals, about 50 miles north of Copper Harbor, Michigan, never found the old-fashioned way by running into them.
Oh, there's that thing.
Whoops, okay. Mark that one on the map. The technology to map the vast areas of the lake at a relatively high resolution now exists. The underwater topography with equipment capable of detecting shipwrecks, pipelines, significant boulders, or rocky outcrops can easily produce charts over a large area with soundings taken less than 10 meters apart, much less in zones with prominent features. And the International Partnership of Non-Governmental Organizations in Ontario called Waterlution and Northwestern Michigan College, they're using this high-tech equipment to bridge the information gap. As the project progresses, the knowledge of the depth, shape, and composition of the bottoms in the Great Lakes provide foundational data. That's cool. It really is, because it has been lacking, and there's some really neat stuff that's at the bottom. There really is. When you go to Lake Erie, there's a significant number of sunken ships that you can actually pull over when the water's calm, and you can see it. You can actually see the sunken ships.
And
with your eyes,
with your locator,
with your eyes. It's okay. On the backside. One of them is on the backside. That'd be the east side of Kelly's Island, which is one of the larger islands off of the southwest side of the Put-in Bay area, southeast side of that. And it's pretty doggone cool. You really can see some cool stuff.
Most of the sunken ships are near the islands.
Many of them.
Or shoreline.
No, some of them aren't. But some of them are located not far from them after they hit something, and then, as they say,
sink.
On down she goes.
Yeah.
So, the story that we highlighted that I'm pretty excited to get into, the title goes, Walleye Love Perch Too Much, So Michigan is Expanding Walleye Fishing. Opinion, Don?
Yeah. Are they talking in the Great Lakes, or are they talking in... inland lakes.
Well, in this case, Saginaw Bay, which is connected to the other stuff.
Yeah.
The National Resource Commission is making a walleye season year-round on the Saginaw River in hopes the anglers will reduce the population of fish, which has been gorging on yellow perch in Saginaw Bay. The order, which passed last week, opens the Saginaw River for an initial 45 days of walleye fishing in the early spring, beginning in 2023. The newly opened walleye fishing window between March 15th and the last Saturday in April is when walleye typically travel through the Saginaw River to spawn. This decision comes at a time when the Department of Natural Resources is implementing new measures to balance walleye and yellow perch predator-prey relationship. What do you think about that, Donald?
Well, you know, that's probably not going to make the perch fishermen very happy.
Yeah, it's not going to make the walleye fishermen happy, because what they're going to do is they're going to be taking fish, and that's a bummer. Based on the DNR data, they say the benefits of opening the Saginaw River walleye season year-round have significant benefits that outweigh any concerns. Potential risks are small. The walleye population is at 5 million. There is a large cushion, so we have the ability to look at the data each year and make quick adjustments if necessary.
Interesting. I said that it's not going to make the perch fishermen happy. It's not going to make the walleye fishermen very happy.
Yeah. It's not going to make walleye fishermen happy at all. In the 70s, the Cisco population was devastated, and the walleye population headed in the same direction. Invasive species were out-competing the walleye, and it was an issue. The population went down to a point where they weren't reproducing and became unviable in Saginaw Bay. And I remember having guys talk about that when we were out there at tournaments. The DNR, along with stakeholders, said the decades-long effort of stocking a walleye back in Saginaw, they hoped it would recover. It has. And they, 700,000, they stocked walleye fingerlings annually, and the bay's surface area is about 728,000 acres. So there's a lot of changes that have been going on in the Great Lakes, that I will say. But I think there's something that you need to be a little careful of as well. And it's one of the things we changed on the river here. When you have a lot of people that come out to that area, you're going to find that they will and can hurt a fishery in a short period of time. And that's one of the reasons why now you have a 20-inch slot with one over 20 inches per person on the Mississippi River here in pools 3, 4, and 5. So I think it's going to be interesting. We'll follow the story. I hope we can pull somebody from the DNR out in the Michigan area and find out what the reasoning is. There better be some solid science behind it. It didn't seem like there were had significant elements that would kind of back that. But you know what? It is what it is, as they say and goes. Well, Happy New Year, everybody, from the Valley Outdoors crew. For myself, Eric, Don, and Ava, we hope you guys have a happy, safe new year. And we're really looking forward to the awesome stuff coming up for us and you guys in the coming year. For that, me and us, we are the Valley Outdoors, and we are out of here.